Today we're still in Joshua chapter 1, and as I did tell you earlier, you will have the impression that we're never going to get through the book of Joshua at the rate we're going. You know, this is the third week in, and we're only hitting verse 18. But by way of one, hopefully encouragement if you're already discouraged about it taking forever. Like I said, back half of the book's a whole lot faster. But also, next week we are going to do the entirety of chapter 2. Okay, so we will be picking up pace here and there. I really thought about doing all of Joshua chapter 1 together because this part flows so naturally from the beginning part, which is why the people who put the chapter numbers in kept it in the single chapter, right? But as far as preaching goes, I think that there was enough to warrant having a second sermon on Joshua chapter 1, in that the first couple of verses, chapter 1, verses 1 through 9, God is talking to Joshua, who is the leader of the people, about being strong and courageous, because you need to see me as the God who fulfills his promises, because we're about to go take that land. I'm going to give it to you. You need to have strength and courage to obey me, as it was talked about, that the whole instruction that Moses had commanded you, that the book of the law should not be absent from your mind or from your mouth, that it should stay with you. And you're going to need strength and courage for that. And that you will also need to be strong and courageous in the knowledge and living like God is with you wherever you go. And it's interesting that in these first 9 verses, when God is having the pregame speech, that he doesn't rile Joshua up in the way that most of us as guys would try to rile us up when we've got a big game ahead, or if we're going to go into battle, we're pumping each other up for the battle. And God here is as well, but it's not the battle you would expect. He's not pumping him up to say, like, make sure your sword's nice and sharp and clean, because we're going to go take on everybody. God says, make sure that you are ready to do the war that I'm calling you to, which in these verses has nothing to do with fighting battles. Those verses will come. I'm not pretending like the whole book of Joshua doesn't have warfare in it. But Joshua chapter 1, when God is talking to Joshua, he makes it very clear that the strength and courage that he needs actually is in relationship to God. Yes, we're going to go into a land. It's my land. I'm giving it to you. Yes, there's going to be conflict. Yes, there's going to be enemies that would like to prevent you from inheriting your promises. However, you need the strength and courage, not so that you can fight well, so that you can win every battle you fight, but you need the strength and courage to listen to me and to follow me and to keep your source of strength and courage on me. It sets the scene for the whole book of Joshua. We're going to see these themes come up again and again. One way that, you know, lots of Bible scholars have kind of settled on a good metaphor, because a lot of times our biblical scholars are really bad at metaphors and, like word pictures and things. So, like, when we find one that makes sense to people who are good at them, we like to just keep them. But just like we say that the Bible is like a tapestry, which, how many of you know what a tapestry is? Guessing there's an age cutoff somewhere. Okay, yep. All right. So, tapestry is, I don't know if the one in my office is technically tapestry, but it looks like tapestry. But you take strings of different color and you weave them deliberately in order to form a picture. And typically in tapestry, it might not be a picture of a person or a building or something. It might just be a design. But you can see how the artist puts the different colors of string to make a picture, even using colors that wouldn't naturally be what you would expect to see, like green on someone's nose, in order to make the shape make sense when you look at it as a whole. And so Joshua is a book that is very much like that, where these themes are woven in, where it's not necessarily so plain and simple to see it as like, oh, this is all that's there. It's that there are so many things being applied in and out and connecting each other that you will see a lot of these things from Joshua chapter 1, which is why we're spending 2 weeks on it, being woven and played out better and explained to us in the coming chapters. So after God talks to Joshua and tells him, be strong and courageous three different times. And he says, we're going into the land that I am giving you, so get ready. Joshua then immediately responds. And isn't this how it goes? When God calls us to do something, then we need to choose to do it or not do it. And then Joshua, he responds, as we would hope, because there's a whole book, that he doesn't say, ah, that's nice, tell someone else to do it. Joshua says, all right, let's do it. So then Joshua, who's the leader of this mass of people who don't have a land to call their own yet, he tells the officers, so there's rankings, he tells the people, go tell all the other people. And what does he tell them to do? Verse 10, Joshua commands the officers of the people, the leaders, it denotes just like leadership, not an official position, but like representatives, and then down into the tribal leaders and then family leaders. He says, go tell everyone through the whole camp, get provisions ready for yourselves, for within 3 days, you will be crossing the Jordan to go in and take possession of the land the Lord your God is giving you to inherit. In this section, Joshua tells his officers, and Joshua himself uses the very words of God from verses 1 through 9 that tell them what we are about to do. So he tells the officers, go tell everybody, pack, get yourself ready. We're moving. And this is not an unusual thing for these people, right? They spent a whole generation of people packing up and wandering through the desert to a different part of the desert. And he says, we're going back up because in 3 days, we are going to cross the Jordan River into the land that God is giving us to inherit. Joshua picks up on exactly the same thing. It's not to say that there's not going to be any conflict, but Joshua doesn't tell him, get ready for battle. He says, get your possessions, we're going in. God's going to give it to us the same way you get to inherit your father's wealth when he passes away. God is giving us the land as an inheritance. It's his to give, and he's giving it to us, and he's going to do it in less than a week. In 3 days, we're going to cross the Jordan River. Now, remembering that when where we are, both geographically and historically, they are on, let me do this for you guys, yes, the east side of the Jordan River, and they had just conquered the two kingdoms over there, the Amorite, two kings of Amorites, one of whom was Og, and if you read the stories in, I think, Numbers and Deuteronomy of that, Og, the king of Bashan, is denoted as a person who had a bed of so many cubits. And if you take a standard cubit of 18 inches, which there's a question of that because cubit is elbow to fingertip. And as we talked about, people that day and age didn't have the average height that we have. So it's probably a little bit short. But anyway, I don't know the number if you do it differently. So you guys can pull your calculators out and say, like, what if it was 15 inches? But if you take 18 inches, his bed was 13 feet long. Now, does that mean he was 13 feet tall? No. But it does mean that he thought it necessary to have a 13-foot bed, which I know some of us, like Daryl, probably would appreciate, having a longer bed than is standard available on the market nowadays. However, it is a reminder there that this land has what the people would perceive as descendants, at least, of superhuman strength people that will be in their way to inheriting the land. And God had already promised to Edom, Ammon, and Moab land, and had to drive giants out of their land as well for them to inherit that land. And so this is well within what God says I'm capable of doing. Don't let the giants scare you off like you did 40 years ago. But the people, under Joshua's military command, but while Moses is alive, inherit this one part of the east side of the Jordan River, even though it wasn't necessarily included in the original promises of the land that Israel would inherit. But because the Amorite kings would not allow them to just walk through their land, God said, all right, now take it. And so three tribes, which is where we're getting to in verse 12, the tribe of Reuben, tribe of Gad, and then half of Manasseh, because Manasseh is a very big tribe, had already approached Moses and said, hey, since we got this land that we weren't necessarily expecting, and it's really good for livestock, like, we've kind of settled here. Like, can we just live here? And Moses had told them, yes, God is okay with you having this be your allotment of land so that you can do what you guys are good at over here. But don't forget that when we do finally cross the Jordan River into the land God did promise us to inherit, that you guys have to come too. And then you can come back later. But you can't just let everybody else fight for their own land, because everyone helped you fight for this land. You see, the entirety of Israel fought the Amorite kings and had fought and taken away from Og his land. All 12 tribes were involved in that under Joshua's military command. And so, Jace, just because it's your land and you don't want more land on the other side of the river doesn't mean you don't come. Everybody helps you get this land. Everybody helps everybody else get all their land as well. And they said, sure, we'll do that. Well, now time has come for them to do this. So Joshua tells the officers of the people, go through the whole camp, tell everyone, get provisions ready for yourself for in 3 days. We're crossing the Jordan River into the land, and God's going to give it to us. Just like he gave us the land on the other side of the river, he's going to give it to us. But Joshua makes a specific trip out to the east side of the Jordan River, and he goes to the tribal leaders of Reuben, Gad, and half tribe of Manasseh. And he says in verse 13, remember what Moses, the Lord's servant, commanded you when he said, the Lord your God will give you rest and he will give you this land. Your wives, young children, and livestock may remain in the land on this side that Moses gave you on this side of the Jordan, but your fighting men must cross over, depending on your translation, in arm, you know, with swords or things, you know, armed, or my translation says cross over in battle formation. So he says, like, you don't have to bring your whole family over the Jordan River. They can stay, but anybody that can fight has to come and come ready to fight, to cross over the river. And you will go ahead of your brothers and help them until the Lord gives you your brothers rest as he has given you, and they too possess the land the Lord your God is giving them. Then you may return to the land of your inheritance and take possession of what Moses, the Lord's servant, gave you on the east side of the Jordan. Joshua comes to specifically these tribes and says, all right, now it's time for you to fulfill your promise. The deal was God was going to give you this land. Moses said, but you have to send people over the other side of the river to help everybody else get the land. Now, they are early inheritors of their land. The whole nation of Israel has helped them take possession of this land, and they're starting to try and get settled in, right? They're dividing out the land between the family clan units and spreading out and all this stuff. And Joshua says, put a pause on that. I need every able-bodied man to come over, because in 3 days we're crossing the Jordan River. And just like your brothers helped you, I expect you to help your brothers. So come with us in battle formation to cross the Jordan. And when the rest of your brothers have the kind of peace you have now, where you don't have enemies coming in and taking stuff from you, and you're trying to sort out who gets what and getting settled in, when that's the state on the other side of the river, you may return and do it over here as well, because you will have accomplished and fulfilled your promise that you made. So Joshua makes a point to go out to these three tribes. Why? The leader has told a bunch of other leaders of the other 9.5 tribes, just go tell everybody, 3 days, pick up your stuff. Within 3 days, we're crossing the river. And he goes to these tribes. One, because think if you were part of the tribe of Reuben. What if you were like on the line of age for fighting? I don't know what the line would have been for them. But let's say, you know, let's say you're like 45 and, you know, it's a lot of swinging swords and spears and stuff. And you're like, I mean, I don't want to say I'm old, right? I don't want to pretend like I'm a cripple, but I don't know that I'm really cut out for this anymore. Do you think you would be all that motivated to strap on some armor and go across the Jordan River to go fight more giants? No. What if you had just finally gotten your house finished? And you're like, all right, now I got to start planting crops to feed my livestock. And Joshua shows up to town. What if Joshua didn't show up to town and just sent somebody else in and said, hey, in 3 days we're crossing the river. Well, that's nice. Good luck. That would be my response. So Joshua knows that there is no selfish motivation for these tribes to send all of their fighting men over the river. They've already got land, more land than they needed. They're already settled. They already have peace. They've already been given what God had promised to them. You can have this land. I will drive out the giants and anyone that opposes you. You may have it. Well, they've already inherited their promise. And so Joshua knows that they don't have to fight for their land because their land is secure already. So maybe they won't want to. So Joshua makes the point to go over himself to see what the state of those two and a half tribes would say. So he tells them, all right, we're packing up and we're going. Now your families can stay put because this is where they live now. But send me every able-bodied man. Send them with every piece of armor and weaponry you have, because the rest of the brothers need the same benefit that you have. So then verse 16, they, the representatives and whoever was there when Joshua was talking, they answered Joshua and said this: everything you have commanded us, we will do. And everywhere you send us, we will go. And people hear what Joshua said, and they said, yes, we are people of our word. Why? Because God, our God, is a God of his word. He says, we will go wherever you tell us to go. We will do whatever you tell us to do. So you want the able-bodied men, we will send everybody we've got. We will send every piece of armory and weaponry we have over the river, even though we're not getting a square foot on the other side of the river out of this deal, we will send them because we said we would. Verse 17 is kind of ironic. We will obey you just as we obeyed Moses in everything. Did they listen to everything Moses told them to do? It's funny, okay? So let's laugh about it for a minute. But it doesn't discount what they're saying. They're not saying we will follow you just like we followed Moses, so like good luck with that. But they are saying, and remember, this is the second generation. This is not the generation that refused to go in and had to wander around the wilderness for 40 years. This is the generation of people who had no voice at that time about whether they went in or not, because they weren't able-bodied fighting men at that point. And they said, we will obey you like we obeyed Moses and everything. Now, that being said, the Israelites who wandered in the wilderness didn't do a whole lot better than the Israelites that went through Mount Sinai and went to the land the first time. They didn't do a whole lot of really good times there either. But they said that what they're really saying here is, we acknowledge that you are the leader. Remember, Moses had died. And when leaders die off, what usually happens? Someone else has to be a leader, right? And so there's usually some sort of chaos about finding out who the leader is. And these two and a half tribes could have easily taken that opportunity to say, well, Moses died. We promised Moses we'd go over the river. I didn't say anything to Joshua. And why would we go follow Joshua over the Jordan River and risk our lives for land we're not getting? So when they said, we will follow you like we followed Moses, they said, the promise we made to Moses still stands. You are the leader of God's people. So if you know, just like nothing has changed. Just because Moses died doesn't mean that our promise that we made to him is dead as well. So we will do it. We'll do what you tell us to do. We will go wherever you tell us to go. And this is because, in addition to fulfilling their word, they knew who Joshua was. Because Joshua had been their commander in military stuff the whole time they're wandering around in the wilderness. And Joshua is the one that helped them get the land that they currently live in. where there are no more giants and nobody to bother them. So they understand they have an obligation, and so they tell him, we will obey you just like we obeyed Moses and everything. It's not them trying to be arrogant and say, we did just such a great job of following Moses, why do you have any questions? What they're saying is, we recognize that you are the leader of God's people. We will follow you. And then they say this as well, and may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. We will follow you like we followed Moses, because we knew Moses and God had a relationship, and we trust that you and God also have that kind of a relationship, so we will follow you. There is something to be said about that phrase. Grammatically, it could be interesting that there might be some ironic overflip there, that the may the Lord your God be with you is kind of left up in the air in English, as far as like they're hoping that God will be with him. But what they're saying is, like, only the Lord with you is what the sentence would be translated 100% literally. And so what they might be saying is, we will obey you as we obeyed Moses and everything. And when that doesn't work out, take your strength from God. Don't take your strength and courage from us. Take it from God, because God is with you as he was with Moses. And so we will do our best to follow what you tell us to do, as we tried to do with Moses. And then they say in verse 18, they issue a decree that says, anyone who doesn't do that, anyone that rebels against your order, does not obey your words, and everything that you command him, will be put to death. Is that... just so you're clear, because this isn't like everybody, it's like leadership. They're saying, we will have the death penalty for anybody in our tribe that will not follow you. It's a serious thing for us to keep our oath. We made an oath that says we will go over and we will help everyone else get their land like they helped us get ours. So we will do it. And if anyone has a problem with it, we will handle it. And then they say this, above all, or only, be strong and courageous. Now, where do you think they got that line from? Probably when Joshua tells them, God comes to me, he tells me this. So they echo God's words back to Joshua. Why? It might just seem like a really cool thing that God's working out, and it certainly is, for these people to say, be strong and courageous. But they use the words of God to give Joshua the assurance, because there's a question mark of, will these 2.5 tribes come with when they've got nothing to gain and everything to lose? And they say, be strong and courageous. Don't be afraid at all. We're coming. We're not going to miss out. We will be there with you every step of the way, because God is with you and we will follow you. Isn't that a beautiful response? God comes to Joshua and says, my servant Moses is dead. Now I'm going to have you prepare the people. We're going across the river. We're going to take the land. And Joshua's like, oh, okay. So then he responds in faith and obedience. He goes to his officers and says, I'll tell everybody that within 3 days we're packing up and we're going across the river. And then he's like, I don't think I've got anybody that I could just send over the river to, you know, down the river, whichever way the direction they were going, to tell these 2.5 tribes, because I think they're going to give me some, like, they're going to push back. Why would I leave? Why would I come? But when he shows up, unlike what has been their go-to status quo response to when God tells the people to do something difficult, instead of saying, like, I don't think that's a good idea, they say, of course we're coming. Thanks for making sure we got the memo. We will pack up. We will leave our houses. We will leave our farms. We will go with everyone else so that everybody else can get a house and a farm. Because this is what we will inherit together. There's a lot of really good themes and lessons in here for us. Starting off with probably one of the more major, maybe even more apparent themes, is that this is a continuation of Joshua's instruction to be strong and courageous, but it's also Joshua's trip over that gives him the confidence that the people of God are united. I think there was a question whether or not these 2.5 tribes would come. And Joshua goes out and sees firsthand, they see themselves not as tribes, but as people of the nation of God. And although they have everything God had already promised them, they will work to see other people get what God has promised them. These 2.5 tribes and their response, and in fact they do, they go over, and although there's nothing that they're like, oh, this is the land that so-and-so told us about, we're going to fight, we're going to settle here, they spend the next several years away from their homes, away from their families, going to war with giants and with cities and with people who oppose them, and they don't get anything extra than what they already got in the first place. But they are still motivated to do it because they don't see themselves as individuals. They don't see themselves as tribes. They see themselves as part of the whole of God's people. Now, in case you're hoping I would just leave it there, I'm not going to. I'm going to maybe kick a dead horse for you. Is that we need to see ourselves that way too. We here in the West have a hard time with individualism, period. Where we think that everything in life centers on us as an individual. Which is funny because we use the word us and it's plural, but anyhow. We think that our lives are ours. And if we invite somebody to come along with us, and they're on our team or they're on our family, great. But we need to see ourselves not as individuals. Although there's individual responsibility, there's individual things that you need to take charge of that other people cannot take charge of for you. Like, you're wrestling with your sin, we can't fix for you. We can support you in it, but you have to be an active leader in it. But we can't just be settled with, well, that doesn't fit my schedule. This isn't my way I want to do things. Oftentimes, you know, in corporate America, you've got like all these meetings of everybody who wants to say like, well, we should do it this way. We should do it this way. And you know what's taking place? I mean, this is normal life. So I'm not saying like this is, some weird thing that's happening. This is just the way we operate as sinners in a broken world, is that we are all trying to be Joshua. We want people to respond to what our suggestion is and say, we will do whatever you tell us to do. We will go wherever you tell us to go. And a lot of our meetings, a lot of our conversations, a lot of our email chains are all about trying to get people to do what I want. This bleeds not just from our day-to-day experience, but it bleeds heavily into how we relate on a spiritual level and on a religious level as well. Here in the West, we have a hard time with this individual concept. But then aside from that, if you can maybe teach yourself to be concerned with the welfare of other believers as well, we still form these little tribes. Now, we don't call them tribes in Christianity. We call them denominations. Call them conferences or fellowships. Or we'll put any word on it other than tribe because we don't like the word tribe. It makes it sound like we're from a third world country. But inside of this concept is, okay, I can see that there's more to life than just me, and there's more than just me and my family, but we identify only with the group of people that are like us, who agree with us, who do life the way we do life, who have the same skill sets or appreciations for the same things as us. You don't notice that, like, the tribes, although I'm sure not every individual was, but these 2.5 tribes came to Moses specifically because the tribes were people who did livestock. Okay? There's another tribe that they're known for being really good at slingshotting. There's another tribe that's a bunch of left-handers. I mean, like, they are divided based on, yes, a family connection, but also they identify with each other, and their strengths are their strengths and their weaknesses are their weaknesses. But if they only see themselves as a tribe and not part of the whole, they are missing out on a whole lot. So even if you can step out of your culture a little bit and say, there's more to life than just me, my family, and my friends. You have to get even another step further and says, it's not even about just the people who do life the way I do it or agree with me on my standards, my preferences, the way I approach life, the way that I think about the Bible and this, that, and the other thing. We have to see ourselves as not just an individual or a tribe, but a part of the whole of God's people. We have to understand that being right or having the perfect way of life, that doesn't mean you can't live that way. These people were farmers of livestock. That's what they did, and they were good at it, and God wanted them to do that, and he gave them what they needed in order to do that. But if they understood their identity as a tribe to be more important than their identity as part of the whole, they would have never stepped foot over the river to help anyone else. I don't spend a lot of time, but I spend some time with plenty of pastors and religious leaders, and we struggle here in America. Even the pastors and leaders struggle with stepping out of our tribe and over the river to help our brothers. We will do everything we can to convince people to stay on our side of the river and to become part of our tribe. We have a hard time accepting that we are not Joshua. And if you fast forward this story into the New Testament area, Jesus is Joshua in the picture. And we might not even be tribal leaders. We don't like it. So we have a hard time, conceptualizing helping other churches or faith communities or organizations or talking to people who don't believe what we believe, how we believe it, or practice it the way we practice it. Like, it's dumbfounding when you say, someone comes to visit our church. I've said, some of you probably have heard me tell you this. Someone comes to our church and they tell me where they're from and say, well, did you notice that you drove past like four other churches to get here? And if they tell me like, oh, we're looking for this, I'm like, oh, yeah, I don't know that we can do that necessarily, but like, here's another one. It confuses people. And I want all of us to understand that, like, you are welcome here. I don't care how many churches you drive past to get here. But that's not the most important part. It's not. Now, I think it is an important part because these tribes identify themselves with the whole, that we also identify ourselves, that we're not lone rangers. We can't go straight from individual to saying, I'm part of God's family, that's good enough. There is a level to which we say, I'm committed to being part of something. Now, it doesn't have to be because I agree with everything that these people do, or I think like them, or I like them the most. But there is a level where you have to identify with a group in order to identify with the whole. Because if someone said, I'm an Israelite, you know what they would ask them? So which tribe are you from? It is a part of who you are. It's not the most important part, but it ought to be a part. It's a hard, everyone, you're getting confused looks out there. It's hard. Well, we can do it together. And these people said the same thing. They even spoke on behalf of all their tribes and said, if anyone has a problem with this, they're not part of our tribe, we will get rid of them. So these people, in a great display of unity, say, we will follow you, Joshua, even though we stand nothing to gain from stepping over the river and helping out our brothers, we will help them. Why? Because they are our family. They are God's people, just like we are, and so we will work for their benefit as well. Second of all, in this, not only is there a great display of unity, there is a great understanding that the work cannot be done by just a small portion of people. They know that they have enough people to make a very real difference in taking the land. And they volunteer to go over and work hard to risk their lives so that someone else can be benefited. Jesus calls us in a similar situation when he's talking to the woman at the well. He's telling her all these things, answering all sorts of questions and saying, like, oh, by the way, that Messiah you're waiting for, that's me. She goes back to town to tell everybody. And the disciples are like, so what are we doing? And Jesus says this, which we love to use during missions focus months. The field is white for harvesting here. But the people who are here to harvest are so little. They have the same problem here. They've got this big chunk of land God told everybody he was giving them, and they don't have enough people to take it all. And these 2.5 tribes respond to Joshua and say, well, we'll volunteer our services, even though we won't get anything out of it. We have an obligation as part of God's people to work for the benefit of each other, even if there's no promise of a return of a benefit to us. We cannot allow ourselves to think, oh, well, let the professionals do it. Let the people who are good at it do it. I'll just sit around. Just like the tribe, these 2.5 tribes identified and said, hey, you're calling us to action. We will do it. Jesus calls you to actually work, and not on your own. Joshua doesn't tell these 2.5 tribes, go over the river and let us know when you've fought everything. We can come over, it's safe. You do it together. And you might not feel like you're as good at it as somebody else. Oh, well. God doesn't say, go ask Gad because Gad's got a lot of good warriors to come along. We have an obligation to work together. And not only do we have an obligation to, God has enabled us to. For us as believers, we have the Holy Spirit inside of us that gives us the ability, the gifting, in order to do it. So we need to identify ourselves with a tribe, a group of people that we're around, and we need to volunteer our gifts God has given to us in order to benefit not just our tribe, but the whole of God's people. I'm not wanting to be up here and tell people, you all have to volunteer for this specific ministry or this specific thing, or you need to give this money or do this thing in order for you to apply this sermon. But I do want you to ask yourselves, ask each other the question, what gift can I volunteer for the service to all of God's people? And how might that benefit the tribe I live in? These are all Old Testament words that are realized in the New Testament. If we were in an epistle, I might use those words. So, these few verses here are the people's response to God's call that has come through their leader to prepare themselves to cross the Jordan River to inherit the land that they are receiving as a gift. Joshua chapter 2, which we'll start next week, starts where most of us would have figured Joshua kind of started. The whole first chapter, we're like, doesn't Joshua start with this? It starts with the spies going into Jericho. But the people of God have been called to enter the land, and this time they say yes. This time they don't bring up all the problems. This time they say, well, if it's God's land and giants live there and God's saying, I'm moving the giants out so you can move in, I guess we'll go. And they did it together. They did it collectively in a united fashion with everybody doing their part, not asking, well, what am I getting out of the deal? Now, I think on occasion, sometimes people might ask in the conquest of the land, well, do I get this piece of the land if I do this sort of thing? But that's not the attitude of the people. People said, it's God's land. He's given it to all of us. So it's on all of us to go and act. God has promised his children an eternal kingdom without sin and without death. And he calls us to work for it. Not because our works will make it happen. Not because if you don't do enough, you won't be allowed in. But to say that that's your identity. That's what I'm going to give you. I'm promising you that. Will you march at my command? So here we see again the theme that God is the owner of not just this land, but in the purview of this book, it's God's land. He will give it to who he wants to give it to. And he asks those people to come, to cross the river and walk in by faith. So we'll pick up in Joshua 2 next week. Dear Father, thank you that you are a God who doesn't need us in order to accomplish your purposes, that you are fully capable of doing everything on your own. But we also thank you that you're not a God who does everything for us that we can treat like a wishing well or a magic genie. That you invite us to follow in faith, to obey your commands, to live the life you not only tell us we need to, but enable us to. We pray that we would be united together, even with people of different perspectives of things that we really think they're wrong on, but we will see them as our brothers, as our sisters, as part of the whole. We pray that we would band together, not so that we could be isolated and off on our own and our nice little tribe, but that we would be banded together so that we as a tribe would have something to offer to benefit everyone. That we would identify our strengths and use them for you and identify our weaknesses as well and allow other people to help us grow in those areas. And we pray that you would help us to rightly evaluate how we think about life and our identity, that maybe we could shuffle it a little bit so we don't think of ourselves as just an individual that has some loose connections to people, but that we also wouldn't pick small parts of our identity and make them far more important. Help us to realize the important part of our identity is that we are yours. And let us work from there to benefit the people around us and the individuals in our family and our friends groups. Help us to be united like your people were united when you called them to action to step over the river and into the land that you were giving them. Help us to volunteer for that service with everything that we have, even if we think it's not much, that we will give it all to follow you. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.